From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The Bush administration is upping the ante this week in its language toward Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. Is the U.S. finally ready to take direct action to bring down the old enemy in Baghdad? First, a campaign finance reform bill is on its way to the Senate today. The bill passed decisively in the House last night after a marathon session. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle says he'll try to bring it to a vote as soon as he receives it. I spoke with Liz Morlantis earlier today. She's a political correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her about the mood in Congress on the morning after passage of the Shays-Meehan bill.
I think it's a mixture of relief on one side and, I guess, sense of defeat on the other. It's been a really long haul for this bill. They've been battling over this issue for 7 years now, and certainly for Congressman Shays and Meehan, who are the co-sponsors of the House bill, it's a tremendous sense of triumph and, I would imagine, exhaustion.
We heard about all the amendments that were being voted on last night. Did the bill emerge in a form that supporters of reform can be really thrilled about?
Yes, it did. They successfully fought off all of the amendments which they had labeled poison pill amendments. In other words, amendments which would have substantially changed the bill so that it would have then been forced into a conference with the Senate. The form that the bill is in now, it can go straight to the Senate for an up and down vote.
Was the House Republican leadership moaning as the thing finally went through?
Well, I think towards the end there was a certain sense of resignation that they started to realize that it wasn't looking good. But certainly this was something they put a lot of effort into this fight. The rhetoric throughout the week was extremely high and extremely nasty at times on both sides.
What's the next step in the process now? How do they get together with the Senate and bring out a bill for President Bush?
This isn't totally clear yet because it goes to the Senate, and of course the Senate's most ardent foe of this bill, Senator Mitch McConnell, has vowed to filibuster. Now, of course, the Senate can prevent him from doing that, but they need 60 votes to do it. And when they passed their version of campaign finance, it passed 59-41. And so in order to prevent McConnell from filibustering, supporters of the bill have to find one more vote on their side. And it's not clear yet whether they're going to be able to do that.
If they do find that vote, how soon might a bill land on President Bush's desk?
I think it would go fairly quickly. And so far, all indications are that President Bush would, in fact, sign it. He has indicated through his spokesman, Ari Fleischer, that they can't count on him to veto it. And Ari Fleischer also made even more encouraging statements yesterday, saying that the president thought that the bill would be reform. And so the sense is that Bush would probably sign it.
Liz Morlantis, of course, if this goes through, the election this fall was exempted from its impact. How would it actually begin to emerge, the impact of it, in the political system?
Well, the biggest impact is going to be, of course, on the national political parties, because what the bill primarily does is it bans soft money contributions to the parties, which in recent years have become a major source of their revenue. It's more than half of the Democratic Party's revenue, and it's nearly half of the Republican Party's revenue. And so suddenly the parties are going to see a huge, they're going to see half their revenue gone. And so they're going to have to focus a lot more on raising the individual hard money contributions, which means things like direct mail activities, all of that sort of retail politics, which is what supporters of the bill want. They say that it will encourage a different kind of politics. It will encourage the parties to get out there and interact with individual voters on a much more personal level.
Soft money was all often brought into play to bring sledgehammer issue ads down on opponents of Republicans or Democrats. Does it mean that those kinds of ads will now disappear? You won't have the ad that doesn't name the candidate it's opposing but crushes the issue they represent?
I think it's likely that, certainly in the beginning at least, we will see fewer of those ads. Of course, one of the things everybody points out is that eventually people find ways around these laws. And this is what we saw the last time there was a reform bill passed, which was in 1974 after the Watergate scandals. Eventually, they figured out how to get soft money into the system. Soft money, in a way, was an offshoot of the 1974 reforms. And so most people say probably eventually loopholes will emerge. But it will take a while. And in the beginning, certainly, I think it's likely that we will see fewer of those ads. That's also one of the issues that is probably going to be most likely to be subjected to a court challenge. There are some groups already, like the NRA, that are saying that they're going to challenge the provision banning issue ads, and so we'll see what happens with that.
So with those provisos, how big a step is this really seen as being? Will it change the American way of doing politics? Will it change big money politics, or is this just a form over substance?
Well, that's a really good question. It's one of those things that you have to look at in both the short term and the long term. In the short term, yes, I think it's going to have a big impact. I think it is going to reduce the amount of money flowing through the political system right now, simply because it's just going to take away a major source of that money right away, and it's going to take a while for the parties and for campaigns and other groups to figure out how to adjust. In the long term, most people think they probably will find ways to adjust and that money will find its way back into the system. You know, even some of the most ardent supporters of this bill, some of the sponsors, Senator John McCain, has said to reporters that he expects that in 20 years, Democratic and Republican senators will be standing exactly where he's standing now, saying that it's time for campaign finance reform.
20 years is a long time, but is there a long-term solution to this problem, or is it just something we have to live with?
It depends how cynical you are, I guess, is the answer. Most people think money is always going to be a part of politics. We live in a capitalist society, and it's very hard to place restrictions on things like that. But I do think that in the short term, we are likely to see some pretty significant changes.
I guess reformers will have to celebrate their progress of the day. What about the Republicans who went against their leadership to vote for this bill? Is there a special circle of hell being reserved for them now somehow by the Republican leadership?
Well, that'll be very interesting to see. I think some of them really did go out on a limb for this bill. Of course, if you look at the Republicans who did vote in favor of the bill, the majority of them were from parts of the Northeast. Most of them came from districts that Gore won as opposed to Bush. So there are certain commonalities that already sort of pulled them out of the mainstream Republican Party. But it will be interesting to see the kinds of repercussions. I think in most cases, they went with what their constituents wanted rather than what the party wanted.
Liz Morlantes is a political correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor in Washington. President Bush put the world on notice yesterday that he is actively weighing his options for how to topple Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein needs to understand I'm serious about defending our country. I think one of the worst things that could happen in the world is terrorist organizations mating up with nations which have had a bad history and nations which develop weapons of mass destruction. It'd be devastating for those of us who fight for freedom. And therefore, we, the free world, are going to must make it clear to these nations they've got a choice to make. And I'll keep all options available if they don't make the choice.
Iraq's vice president later scoffed at the heated language of the Bush administration, calling it typical of, quote, American invaders. But Washington's posture toward Saddam Hussein is now more threatening than any time since the Gulf War. This isn't the first time America has threatened Hussein. Is now the time for the U.S. to act? Is the U.S. ready to take down Saddam Hussein? Are you? And if it's going to happen, how should it be done? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from Washington, D.C. is Michael O'Hanlon. He's a senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution and co-author of Defending America, The Case for Limited National Missile Defense. Good evening and welcome, Michael O'Hanlon.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Good to have you. And joining us in our On Point studio is our On Point news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon, chair of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. Hello, Lewis Gordon.
Good evening.
Michael O'Hanlon, how do you read the new language coming out of Washington this week? What's brewing here?
You know, I think we can do a lot of Kremlinology trying to figure out who's thinking what inside the Bush administration. But the bottom line is the president's going to have the only decision, of course, and he's going to get advice on both sides of this issue, and he hasn't made up his mind. So the bottom line here is that if I had to predict where his instincts and his emotions seem to be leading him, it's towards some kind of decisive military action. But I don't think he's really decided that, and I don't think he's decided what form it would take. And finally, I think that if Saddam Hussein were to relent and allow in weapons inspectors and let them do their jobs, the president would be in a hard position. He would have a hard time then saying to the world, we have to overthrow this man. So in a sense, Saddam can choose his own fate here. And I don't believe the president has necessarily decided that he's going to overthrow him no matter what.
And yet this is not obscure criminology this week. The language is pretty plain and right out front. Colin Powell, speaking to Congress, is talking about the axis of evil. He said, with respect to Iran and with respect to North Korea, there's no plan to start a war with these nations, very clearly and loudly leaving Iraq out of that formula.
That's true, but if you look at what would be required to be confident that we could unseat Saddam Hussein, and I don't just mean to have a chance, I mean to be confident and to do this job and do it right. You're talking about a couple hundred thousand American forces, in my judgment, being deployed to the region just in case the other kinds of tools we might have at our disposal don't work. And I don't think the president has really signed up to that kind of a major military mission yet. At the same time, you could have Iraqi Scud missiles launched at Israel and Saudi Arabia again, perhaps with weapons of mass destruction this time. Iraqi terrorists might try to infiltrate into the United States and use weapons of mass destruction here. If you go after Saddam Hussein, you're talking about a major war that's going to be riskier than Desert Storm. And I don't think the president has conveyed the kind of clear resolve and decision making yet that has led him to that decision. I think he's considering it. I'm pretty sure he's not there yet.
But there's certainly a lot of groundwork being laid here, starting with the State of the Union speech where he laid out the axis of evil notion. Now Colin Powell singling out Iraq, Dick Cheney coming up on a visit to the region. He's going to be in all the nations that border Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Turkey, and then Britain, Egypt, Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, Oman. This sounds like a reprise of the Gulf War coalition.
Yeah, I agree with your point that the groundwork is being laid, and we should certainly think of this as making it possible to do many things against Iraq, should we so choose. I think the president realizes you need to establish legitimacy to any such operation. You need to establish public support. You need to get people debating this on shows like yours. You can't just attack Iraq out of the blue. But there are reasons to consider doing so, and if we discuss them with our allies, with our own citizens, then we are sort of preparing ourselves just in case that's the course ultimately adopted. I think that's what's going on.
We're going to get into all that tonight, but let's just look at the likely sequence of events. You said, and you've written, that there's no point in attempting this if you're not willing to go in with a ground invasion. Anything shy of that would run a high risk of failure. You point out that that might take 200,000 troops. That's a far, far cry from Afghanistan. And that the first thing that's likely to come is a request or perhaps Saddam Hussein even saying that he would agree to weapons inspections. But can you really imagine Baghdad opening Iraq up to the kind of really thorough scrutiny that the United States would insist on?
Well, you know, if Saddam has no real choice, if he becomes convinced that it's either do that or get overthrown, then yes, I think he will let weapons inspectors in. So you could argue that Mr. Bush is taking a very smart strategy towards getting those weapons inspectors back, and only by raising this real specter of a major military operation is Saddam ever going to possibly change his mind on inspections.
But isn't it just as likely that the inspectors will ultimately go in and that Washington will say they're not being allowed what they need to do, now the tripwire has been crossed, here we go?
Yes, and you're right. And there are people in Washington who are actually afraid of that scenario because it gets murky. If Saddam lets the inspectors do three-fourths of what they are asking to do, but not the last one-fourth, is every country in the world going to agree with us that that's unacceptable and therefore Saddam needs to be attacked militarily in a major ground invasion with the purpose of overthrowing his regime and replacing it with another one? I'm not so sure. So there are actually people in Washington who are afraid they may get an answer of yes from Saddam, although it'd be a conditional yes, and he would try to obstruct whatever inspections he chose to. There's that very distinct possibility. However, I think if Saddam is reading American politics correctly, and heaven knows he's made mistakes before, but if he's reading American politics correctly, he will recognize that he has to let these inspectors back in and let them do their jobs unimpeded. Otherwise, he probably will be overthrown. That would be my prediction of what's going to probably happen here.
Overthrown, we'll talk about that. But first, Lewis Gordon, you hear the rhetoric being ratcheted up. What do you feel is brewing?
Well, I'm not a particularly good predictor of issues like these. I think the experts in that are better. But the thing that strikes me is, at least that's annoying at me, is the question of why now. I mean, Saddam Hussein has pretty much been doing the same thing since 91. And in many ways, I mean, the ground troops were there. The question is, why now? And one of the things that's going through my mind is that not only with what just happened in Afghanistan, but also there's a whole new set of economic relations being set set in place, something must be benefiting the administration right now in terms of what a strike like this would mean.
It's a big question you raise. Why now? We'll talk about it after a break. We're talking with Michael O'Hanlon and Lewis Gordon about the growing pressure on Iraq. The Bush administration clearly laying the groundwork for something. Is this the time for Washington to go into Iraq to take out Saddam Hussein? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back to talk about it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the Bush administration's dramatic ratcheting up this week of its language toward Baghdad and Saddam Hussein in particular. The phrase of the week is regime change. And make no mistake, that means taking out Saddam Hussein, if that's what it comes to. And certainly that's the kind of noose that seems to be being laid here. But we're interpreting what it all means tonight. Our guest is Michael O'Hanlon. He's senior fellow in policy studies at the Brookings Institution. And in our studios, tonight's news analyst, Lewis Gordon, chair of the Africana Studies Department at Brown University. What do you think? Is it time to take Saddam Hussein out of power? Are you ready to support dramatic action, major military action in Iraq? Or if Saddam says he'll be good, should the U.S. accept that? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A couple of things that came up before the break. Michael Henn, let me follow up with you first. You said it could happen that Saddam Hussein, under this pressure, might be overthrown before a military action is required, if I understood you correctly. What are the odds of that?
I think they're pretty low unless we begin to mobilize force. I try to imagine, it's a horrible thought, but imagine myself in the position of one of the Iraqi army officers who we have to count on to change his position and overthrow Saddam. Mm-hmm. And the question is, what is that person going to fear most? Today, that person fears Saddam far more than he fears us. All he gets out of Washington right now is a lot of talk and an occasional cruise missile or a bomb from 15,000 feet altitude. Mm-hmm. What he gets from Saddam is a bullet in the head if he blinks wrong. And therefore, the question is, at what point will that person change his allegiance? I think that person will only change his allegiance when he recognizes that American victory is inevitable, and that only becomes inevitable when we have a couple hundred thousand forces on his doorstep. So if you prepare for a big mission, you may not have to carry it out. But if you fail to prepare for it, I think the less intense tools and the smaller tools will probably fail. My guess is we're going to have to get ready for Desert Storm 2 if we want this to work. Whether we have to carry it out or not, I'm not sure. Saddam may fall if we have a couple hundred thousand Americans on his doorstep, but I think we're going to have to at least get ready and get deployed to make that happen.
But what a fine line between deploying that sufficient and significant threat and putting it into action.
Absolutely. You have to do this with the expectation that you're going to have to carry it out and actually fight on your own on the way to Baghdad. And if you don't have that willingness, you shouldn't get into this business in the first place. And that's why I find much of the Washington debate today objectionable and sometimes even irresponsible, because there are a lot of people going around saying the Afghanistan model will work in Iraq. I think those people are simply wrong. And I think they are leading us down a path of sort of marching to war very casually without really facing what might be required and the real risks.
But the Bush administration seems to pride itself on jangling big spurs, saying that they've shown they'll follow up on their threats, that Afghanistan is the proof. And you hear that again today or yesterday in George Bush's comments saying Saddam Hussein has to understand that we're serious. Are you suggesting that the administration is not even internally aware of what being serious means when it comes to taking on Baghdad?
No, it's a good question. I'm not so worried about the administration, frankly, because with people like Colin Powell in mm-hmm. there, I think that if they do this, they will be prepared to do it right. At least that's my real hope and expectation. I think Colin Powell, I could imagine him around a table with five or six top advisors to the president saying, listen, Mr. President, we don't need a strategy here that's a hope to win strategy. We must have a strategy that guarantees victory. And the way you do that is with major American ground forces. Nothing else can be assured of success. And I really think in the end the president's going to be swayed by that kind of argument. I think if he goes down this road, he will do it in a serious way. I'm more worried about the sort of punditry class and some of the members of Capitol Hill, of the mm-hmm. Senate and the House, and some former officials who seem to be very enthusiastic for this war and of the belief that it will go quickly and easily, and to put it in the words of a Washington Post op-ed yesterday, that it will be a cakewalk. I think speaking in those terms is frankly verging on irresponsible.
We're going to talk about what alternatives there might be to a major military action and also what the risks of such an action are. But what about Lewis Gordon's question first, Michael O'Hanlon? Lewis Gordon wonders, why now? I mean, there's this
semi-arbitrary framework of the war on terror that George Bush has put in motion. There's the fact that we have a greatly increased military presence in the region. But fundamentally, what's driving the clock here?
Well, you know, I don't personally think this war is necessary, but let me imagine I was making the argument for why now. What I would say is that after September 11, we have to be a lot more vigilant. We cannot take the kinds of chances we were essentially willing to accept before that date. And the very possibility that Saddam Hussein would think about giving biological agents to Al-Qaeda or another terrorist, hoping that we would never figure out that he was the source of that agent, that very possibility has now become unacceptable. In addition, of course, the sanctions on Iraq are not airtight, and there's an increasing chance each and every year that Saddam is getting closer to having a nuclear weapon. Now, if he had one, I'm not sure he would really use it, because he knows it would be suicide to use it against the United States or Israel, but he could become more threatening and feel that he had another card up his sleeve to try to play in threatening his own neighbors or his own people. So those are the sorts of arguments I think that you would make to say why this year or this moment in history is the time to now again consider going to war against Saddam. I don't find those arguments fully persuasive, but I have to admit there's something to them.
Lewis Gordon, do you have an answer in mind, in your own mind, when you ask why now?
Well, as I'm thinking it through, I'm thinking through two political thinkers. One of them is Judith Sklar, when she talked about liberalism of fear. And liberalism of fear is usually used in a context to support something that may be grounded in something deeper, which is something that may serve a particular interest. Now, for instance, the president recently, especially in environmental issues, he made it very clear that for him the economy stands first. And it strikes me that it's very spurious whether ultimately, although it's publicly the moral charge and the liberalism of fear aspect of it, you know, the idea that we're held hostage to this question of terrorism, there's a deeper reality that it may be in our long-term economic interest for there to be a destabilized Middle East, particularly in terms of its lower infrastructure and what may be happening in terms of developments of oil in, say, Russia.
You mean we would turn to an alternate supply?
An alternate supply. And if that were to happen, ultimately we're talking about a devastated, at least Middle Eastern, Islamic-run areas. These are areas that have invested quite a bit of their infrastructure in oil. And if a shift like that occurs, not only are they going to be looking at a future that is less economically endowed, but in many ways we'll be looking at a future in which the at least the dictates of policy, the questions of rule, will shift. I think, for instance, of Robert Keohane's position at Duke University. He makes a distinction between informal violence and formal violence. Informal violence, so when private individuals, you know, may even make a statement against a nation, like terrorists. But formal violence is when a nation declares war. And right now, at least officially speaking, the nation that's been declaring wars, has been this country. So in the very structure of these relationships, the very fact that we're outwardly just saying things to Saddam Hussein like this, even though these troops are not there, language like that is already at least verbally a declaration of war. And in a situation like that, he's already warned. And the question is, when nations go to war, when nations going to war, there's usually something that serves not simply moral interests, but other interests that are deep down. And I'm sure that there's something economic at the end of the road here.
We want to dig into the potential consequences, economic and otherwise, of an invasion. It's fascinating how these hours dovetail. Donald Kagan said to preserve empire in the last hour, you've got to be willing to do this. Lewis Gordon, you're pointing out that the U.S. is driving the language, but then President Bush says, look, there's a threat here, and Michael O'Hanlon seems to agree at some level there's a threat that is serious and we have to take seriously. Let's bring our callers into this conversation. Lars is on the line. Welcome, Lars. You're on the air.
All right. How you doing?
We're well, thanks.
Great. You know, I think we do have the determination to go in and take out Saddam Hussein, and we probably will if we set our minds to it. And you know, but the question is, how many enemies will we make in the process? And are we going to get flanked in the long run or in the short run, maybe by the democratizing of technologies? I read an article about this recently, like movable type.
Are we afraid of movable type now? I'm really getting paranoid.
You know, people can throw those things. What I mean is that the technologies and things we can't predict are going to come around that we're going to have to be watching for. We might want to think about making friends and trying to think about, as a big empire, how we're going to survive in the future, how we're going to maybe spread the good that we can do in the world rather than fighting last decade's war.
Lars, it's a great point. Let's put it to Michael O'Hanlon. And in a way, Michael O'Hanlon, it's related to what Lewis Gordon has just observed. Yes, we have the structure to go into a big conflict, and if we really put our minds to it and our materiel to it, no doubt to win it. But what constitutes victory today when the backlash might be a suitcase bomb or Stinger missiles or Lord knows what else? Is it still, are we responding in an old-fashioned way, or is it the only way?
It's a tough question. It could work either way. If we overthrow Saddam quickly and successfully, and his forces defect and wind up not fighting very hard, this could be one of the best things for the Iraqi people and country you could imagine, and for the region as a whole. And it could stabilize the region as opposed to destabilizing it, because Saddam Hussein is nobody's friend in that region, whether it's his own people's or his neighbors. And his existence is a destabilizing fact in and of itself. So that's the positive scenario. The negative scenario is we go in, we don't really fight with conviction, we just do a little bombing, we give a few arms to insurgencies around the borders of Iraq, we do destabilize the country, we don't make any major dent in Saddam's hold on power, the Iraqi people continue to suffer, our position in the Arab world suffers because Arabs see us as, again, the enemy of the Iraqi people, we just want to go after our nemesis Saddam Hussein without making any major difference in the lives of the people of his country. Mm-hmm. That's the negative scenario. Frankly, it could go either way. That's why I say, if you're going to do this, you got to do it right. If you go to war against Iraq, you have to succeed and succeed quickly and then help the country get back on its feet and help stabilize a new government and help it rebuild its economy. If you don't do those things, then all the concerns that Lars and Lewis have raised, I think, become very real.
Mm. Very real and maybe unavoidable, even in the case of a victory, if it's not just right. Michael O'Hanlon and Lewis Gordon, stand by. We're joined now by Ren Rahim Franke, director of the Iraq Foundation in Washington, D.C. Good evening and welcome.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Ren Rahim Franke, tell us first about the politics of the Iraq Foundation so that we understand what you're representing in perspective here.
Yes, I not representing anybody, but the Iraq Foundation is a group that supports democratization, human rights, rule of law in Iraq, and we are therefore opposed to this regime, and we want to see a democratizing process get launched in Iraq.
All right, we understand. So then, when you have observed and heard the skyrocketing rhetoric in Washington this week, are you welcoming this? Do you think this is the way that the United States ought to be leaning, or not?
I welcome it with caution. I have to tell you that I have been running the foundation for 10 years now, and I have seen American policy towards Iraq seesaw from extreme interest in getting rid of the regime and supporting the opposition and so on, to fallow periods when no one wants to talk about Iraq, no one wants to hear about Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I must say that the debate that we're hearing now is more intense than what we've heard since 1992, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also sustained. It's not only intense, but it's been going on for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very serious statements made in Congress, made by the president and so on, which do indicate that this administration is bent on doing something serious in Iraq. But I am cautious because, as your earlier commentator said, there is an enormous danger, which we have seen before, that the United States will do another Desert Fox. That is, do a punitive bombing of Iraq in order to get, for example, the inspectors back in, or just to punish Iraq for not allowing inspectors in, and then to withdraw. Now, this, I think, is the most dangerous thing that the U.S. administration can do.
Why do you see that as the most dangerous thing?
Oh.
Why exactly?
Oh, because Saddam thrives on showing the United States as the aggressor. He turns to the Iraqi people. He says, look at what this imperialist, American imperialist, Zionist, etc. power is doing.
It actually strengthens him, you say.
Of course. And not only does he address the Iraqi people, he goes out to the Arab world.
Right. So, but let's say that that's not the Bush administration's leaning here, and certainly that's not the way they like to present themselves. Much more than the Clinton administration, they're prepared to stand up and be enthusiastic about going all the way.
Right.
If they do that, Can you anticipate a stable status quo on the other side of the fall of Saddam Hussein if that should come to pass, and whether quickly through some internal opposition or after a bloody and large conflict? Is there a successor regime, a government that you can imagine coming in and bringing stability to Iraq?
Well, I think, first of all, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is that it would be very important for the United States. And indeed, at that moment, the moment when this regime ends, for the international community to be engaged in Iraq. This is a very important factor. I heard you talking about Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Let me just say that there is one big difference between Iraq and Afghanistan that is to Iraq's advantage, and that is that we have not been through a long civil war. Mm-hmm. This is not a country of warlords. Mm-hmm. This is not a country where everybody is armed to the hilt and has been hitting at everybody else for the last 10 years.
And it's worth remembering that it was only 10, 15 years ago Iraq was seen as the great modernizing hope in the Middle East.
Well, but that was only in the minds of Westerners.
Uh-huh.
Not in the minds of Iraqis. Iraqis who are dying at the front and whenever possible deserting from the army in droves 10 years ago or 15 years ago, understood that this was not the modernizing power in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that the entire world refused to see. The Iraqis were the only one who knew exactly what was going on.
Rendrahim Franki, what do you think, in your heart of hearts, is driving the timetable here? What do you think do you buy that it's Washington's concern about the development of weapons of mass destruction, certainly a legitimate concern if that's what they think is going on, or is it something else in your mind?
Again, I do agree with your commentators, but I do have another thing to add, which nobody mentioned. First of all, yes, weapons of mass destruction. Why now? Iraq has been developing them for a long time. Well, because 9/11 has made us understand that time is not on our side. We can't wait. We should not wait until it happens before we react, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's another big factor, and that is the presence of U.S. troops in the Gulf.
Do you mean the additional troops since September 11th or just the fundamental basing there?
I mean the fact that there have been American troops in Saudi Arabia since 1990, that there is tremendous restlessness in Saudi Arabia about this, that the Saudi government feels uncomfortable, in fact, feels vulnerable about this.
Why would that lead the U.S. to want to act against Iraq?
Well, one of the major reasons that that U.S. troops are in Saudi Arabia is to protect the oil wells of Kuwait and Saudi Arabia from any potential Iraqi attack.
But how does attacking Iraq improve the situation of American troops there?
It gives an exit strategy.
I see. Win and go.
Yes.
Now we see. If they're going to have to go out in a blaze of...
Well, not go out of... It is important to eliminate the cardinal reason why the troops went to Saudi
mm-hmm.
Arabia in 1990.
Mm-hmm. So take care of the issue and then
right.
and then go.
Yes.
Rendrahim Franki, we're coming up to a break, and I know we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you, Tom.
Rendrahim Franki is director of the Iraq Foundation in Washington, D.C. Lewis Gordon, there we see another view of what may be going on here. If they've got to go do the tough business first before they lose those Saudi bases.
Indeed, especially if one's going to shift to another part of the world, perhaps a little more north.
perhaps a nice suburb of Baghdad, but yet it's not really funny. These are heavy issues. Listeners, is it time to take Saddam Hussein out of power? Do you recoil at that language, or are you ready to see it done? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Washington gearing up the language and maybe a whole lot more toward Iraq. They're talking about regime change. Saddam Hussein must go, we're hearing. Listeners, do you believe the U.S. can topple Saddam Hussein without war, with covert operations? Are you ready to take a whack at the axis of evil? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Our guests is Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, and our news analyst tonight, Lewis Gordon, Chair of the Africana Studies Department at Brown. A lot of you are on the line. Let's turn there. Charles is on the line. Welcome. You're on the air, Charles.
Good evening, Tom. Just a quick comment, and then I have a question for Michael O'Hanlon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm amazed at how we talk about this issue as though we Americans have a right to just sit here and discuss the fate of Iraq.
That is the tone.
What, you know, are we throwing out the charter of the UN here? We've thrown out the ABM treaty. The UN charter says very definitely that nations should not aggress against other nations. And this would be pure aggression. We have no, you know, Iraq has not hit us with anything at this point, and we would be going right after Iraq. It would definitely be aggression. I don't know if the Security Council would never vote that way because we wouldn't allow it. But it definitely is aggression, it seems to me. But my question for Michael O'Hanlon is, isn't there a possibility the administration would end up considering what is called an offensive counterproliferation raid, which would really just mean using the Air Force to bomb targets that are considered to be weapons of mass destruction targets.
Got it. Charles, thank you for your call. Thank you very much. And we'll put it to Michael O'Hanlon. What about just more bombing, Michael O'Hanlon? And I guess if I could add beyond that, what about alternatives to all-out war, covert ops, special forces? Is there something that could be done without the 200,000?
Well, starting very quickly with the first point Charles made, I actually think we do have the legal and moral right to go to war against Saddam Hussein because he is in violation of the ceasefire resolutions at the end of the Persian Gulf War in 91, and he's in violation of UN Security Council resolutions of the utmost seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, I think we have the right, and certainly morally, the world would be better off without Saddam than with him. I think it's a question for us whether we're prepared to bear the burden and accept the risks to ourselves and our allies. Morally speaking, I would say that there is an argument in favor of doing this on balance. That's just my own opinion.
Okay, but, and alternatives, bombing others?
Yeah, in terms of bombing weapons of mass destruction sites, we've tried to do that at numerous times. Your previous guest talked about Desert Fox in 1998. Mm-hmm. Those tend not to be very successful because Saddam knows that we have that interest and we've tried before. And
covert ops, then?
And therefore, he puts these things in basements. Mm-hmm. In terms of covert operations, Saddam is one of the best people in modern history at protecting his regime from internal challenges or even small infiltrations from people who might be able to get at him. He tries never to sleep in the same place twice. Mm-hmm. He has a number of body doubles. He has a very loyal immediate presidential guard that he rewards with extraordinarily high perquisites, and also he, of course, retaliates ruthlessly against anybody in that circle who would ever consider turning against him. He has a backup to that force called the Special Republican Guard, about 25,000 forces that are deployed in and around Baghdad. Then he has his Republican Guard, about 70,000 more, not quite as dependable, but still he's got these circles of loyalty.
Not a lot of obvious chinks in that armor.
Yeah, I think he's in pretty good shape against that kind of mission, and I think we would fail.
Krikor is on the line. Welcome, Krikor. You're on the air.
Yes. I want to make a hypothesis first. But,
all right.
As reprehensible as Saddam is, I think we are barking up the wrong tree badly again
so?
In the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I think fundamentally our Middle East policy is terribly flawed, but that's a whole nother long subject. I want to present the hypothesis as follows. Let's assume we succeed in pressuring Saddam into inspections again.
All right.
Let's assume we find violations, as we would presume we would. Let's assume we tell him we have to dismantle, he has to dismantle, and he refuses again.
Mm-hmm.
We're right back to where we were in 1990, and we bomb the sites and or we put sanctions on them, all of which have failed in the past, and will probably fail again.
Right. It's a great point, and I'm going to have to leave it there, Krikor, because we're running out of time. But Michael O'Hanlon, doesn't that get right down to it? Is the whole pressure for sanctions just part of the minuet of building up to military action anyway?
Well, I think the caller raises a very great concern, but I think that in that situation, we would not tolerate, as you say, we would not tolerate that. We would use this as a pretext for war. And I think President Bush has decided this is going to define his presidency, this issue of countering global terrorism as he defines it. I grant you that Saddam Hussein is not really known to be the top terrorist threat to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But President Bush has decided that he is going to treat the problems as part of a broader whole. And I have no doubt that even 2-3 years from now, if that's when Saddam finally impedes these inspectors, even at that point, I think President Bush would be prepared to escalate, because our country is not going to be the same for quite a while after 9/11, and President Bush is never going to be the same president after 9/11. This was really an historic event, and if Saddam tries to play games, I think he will ultimately find the United States is prepared to escalate.
Michael O'Hanlon, our time is almost up, but I want to just put it to you. The risks of this, massive civilian military casualties, instability throughout that region may threaten the territorial integrity of some of Iraq's neighbors, economic chaos, if we send oil prices through the roof. Even if we win, could we lose?
Well, I'm not sure if we could really lose. I think in the end, most regimes that would replace Saddam's would be at least marginally better. But we might not gain a whole lot if we do this wrong. I think the real concern, and again, I share the view of your caller from the Iraq Foundation in Washington, the real concern here is that we will not be resolute. Mm-hmm. We will bomb a little. We will try to get some kind of vengeance or do some kind of a punitive strike. We will not succeed in overturning Saddam. Life will be a little worse for the Iraqi people. Life will be worse for us because our allies in the region will question our judgment and think we're sort of bloodthirsty and just going after our old nemesis, Saddam Hussein. Mm. That's the scenario I worry about. Mm. But if we're serious about overthrowing him, I don't particularly think it's necessary to do so. But if we are serious, I think we will make the region more stable and make the lives of the Iraqi people better. Mm. But at some risk, perhaps thousands of casualties to Americans, Israelis, Saudis, and others.
Michael O'Hanlon is Senior Fellow in Foreign Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author of Defending America, the Case for Limited National Missile Defense. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Lewis Gordon, our time is so short, but last word goes to you.
Oh, the only thing that's on my mind right now is the extent to which Bush Jr. would try to not make mistakes of Bush Sr. There was not only the issue of in terms of the popularity of the war, but the reality is that the economic decline afterward affected that presidency seriously. Mm-hmm. Bush right now faces that issue not only of economic decline, but he also faces a question of the extent to which this war can be continued. He has given himself a lot of leeway by stating that it'll be indefinitely waged.
Yeah.
And in many ways, and although it's an awful thought, mm-hmm. The reality is although the 9/11 was bad for everyone morally concerned, it was very good for this administration. And that's something that the nation will have to be dealing with for some time to come.
He's not afraid to talk about long-term war. Lewis Gordon, stand by. Several of Enron's former top executives have refused to testify before congressional subcommittees investigating the company's bankruptcy. But today, former Enron VP Sharon Watkins gave damning testimony against the company's former CEO, Jeffrey Skilling, and other top executives. She also defended former Enron chairman Kenneth Lay, who she says had no idea of the shady dealings the company was involved in. Here are some excerpts of the exchange between Watkins and Congressman Bill Towson from Louisiana.
I do believe that Mr. Skilling and Mr. Fastow, along with two very well-respected firms, did dupe Ken Lay and the board.
Well, specifically, you say that. You say that as CEO, Mr. Lay relied upon his COO, Mr. Skilling, as well as CFO Fastow and CAO Causey to manage the details. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is that accurate? Was Mr. Skilling expected to manage the details of these transactions?
From all the records and the presentations that I have reviewed, Mr. Skilling was supposed to be an integral part of the controls and the review process with the LJM transaction.
You say that also in the memo that Mr. Lay should admit that he trusted the wrong people. Are you saying that Mr. Lay was wrong to trust Mr. Skilling and Mr. Fastow and Mr. Causey with these details?
Yes, sir. I do believe they misserved Mr. Lay, the board, Enron, and its shareholders.
In fact, you go on to say that Ken Lay and his board were duped by a COO who wanted the targets met no matter what the consequences, a CFO motivated by personal greed, and two of the most respected firms, Arthur Andersen & Company and Vincent Elkins, who had both grown too wealthy off Enron's yearly business and no longer performed their roles as just about everybody on the street would expect as a minimum standard for CPAs and attorneys. Do you believe that statement to be true?
Yes, sir, I do.
You say further on, the culprits are Skilling, Fastow, Glisson, Causey, as well as Arthur Andersen and Vincent Elkins. Do you believe that statement to be true?
Yes, sir, I do.
Now, Ms. Watkins, you made it as clear as I've ever seen anybody make it. You basically outlined for Mr. Lay what would happen if he did the right thing, if he cleaned up this mess, reported correctly to his stockholders and investors, if he got rid of the culprits, and if he made these public statements on behalf of the corporation that he, in fact, was going to do everything to save his company, and that if he didn't take that advice, you told him the worst is going to happen, it's going to happen anyhow, and Mr. Lay will be more implicated in this than is deserved. What did you mean by that?
Mr. Lay was back at the helm as CEO, and it is my humble opinion that he did not understand the gravity of the situation the company was in.
As I understand your memo to him, you're basically telling him that these officials of his corporation were engaging in these essentially improper activities, were doing it in a way that he and his board were being duped, kept in the dark. Who had the power to protect those people from discovery from Mr. Lay and his board? Who had the power to allow these activities to go forward by all of these employees, including investing in themselves in some of these outside partnerships and entities at great profit? Who had the power to let all that happen and keep that information from the board and Mr. Lay all that while?
Well, my opinion would be that would be Mr. Skilling.
And finally, Ms. Watkins, I refer you to the document entitled Lessons Learned, tab 8. In that document, there are 3 points. Recognize the effect of the accounting hedge versus an economic hedge. Corporation should consider hedging assets in Raptor to minimize credit capability volatility. The new Raptor structure transferred risk in the form of stock dilution. Did you show this document to Mr. Lay?
Yes, I did.
Now, it contains some handwriting. Whose handwriting is that?
That's my handwriting.
The handwriting basically says to the final point, there it is. That is a smoking gun. You cannot do this. What did this mean?
Well, my concern was that this was a document Enron had produced. It was well known. And what that bullet point is trying to say in plain English is that the new Raptor structure transferred income statement equity investment risk in the form of stock dilution. And you can never use your stock to affect the income statement.
You just can't do that legitimately, legally.
That's correct.
Where'd you get this document?
From the Risk Assessment and Control Group run by Mr. Richard Bai.
There's another note you wrote on the second point. The corporation isn't Raptor. How could corporation consider anything at Raptor? What did you mean by that?
Well, the bullet point just as Corp should consider hedging assets in Raptor to minimize, you know, some problems. And if Raptor's supposed to be Mr. Fastow's company, then it's Mr. Fastow's problem. Why
Not
should Enron Corporation consider anything there? Exactly.
Even with this, you still say he didn't get it?
I don't think so.
Thank you, ma'am.
Enron good gal, former VP Sharon Watkins, talking with Louisiana Congressman Bill Towson. Lewis Gordon, in demeanor, Sharon Watkins is no rebel, but as a truth teller, she was a kind of rebel at Enron, it sounds like.
Yes. I keep thinking about what the comedian Dennis Miller said, which is that next time you board a plane, the individual sitting next to you might be a former Enron exec. In a nutshell, the fact of the matter is the nation is hailing the decline of crime, but there's a heavy rise in corporate crime, in white-collar crime, and I think this woman should be a hero, just simply put.
Well, she certainly was given a hero's welcome in Washington today. It's fascinating to hear in that detail. The radio really does convey the rustling of the papers, the murmur behind, the tension in the room.
She has a lot of integrity, and I applaud her.
It's great to see it, no matter how it's packaged. Bravo to Sharon Watkins. Lewis Gordon, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Listeners, you can hear more of Sharon Watkins' testimony on our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.